Legowski.
Thank you, Senator Hobbins, Representative Hink, and distinguished members of this committee. It has been an honor and a privilege of mine for the last year to co-chair the Governor's Ocean Energy Task Force with Don Perkins, who regrets that he can't be here today, but who has submitted a letter to you, which we will not read into the record for the sake of time. And also would like to send the regrets of former Governor Angus King, who would not be here, could not be here today, but would like to attend work sessions. So I want to show you, I have a handout that should be in front of you. It includes my testimony, which I'm not going to read for the sake of time, and I would like to walk you through the pictures that was attached to that testimony and then quickly go through what the bill does. And I'm going to try to very much not repeat the eloquent speakers, the senators and representatives who spoke before me. So I'm going to move quickly and just hit the high points of why the Ocean Energy Task Force made the recommendations it did and what is in the bill before you that implements those recommendations. As you'll see from my first slide, which shows the main family energy budget, as Representative Berry just said, the percentage of our family budget that's going to energy has been increasing and is projected to increase if oil prices go back to where they have been, and many people feel they will. But if you look further at that, the breakdown is pretty interesting, and you may already know this, but 90% of a family's energy budget goes to the heating and transportation sector. Most of that in Maine is going to oil. And that is why, that was the backdrop of the formation of the Governor's Ocean Energy Task Force. The next slide shows you what the vision of the task force is. And this is important because many of these sections are in the bill to advance this vision. The past has been reliance on the gas tank and an oil furnace for most people in Maine. The vision of the Ocean Energy Task Force, particularly Habib Dagher and George Hart, Angus King, and others, is that we can have a future energy source that is powered by clean, renewable energy generated both onshore and offshore in Maine in an environmentally responsible way that respects the historic and valuable uses by fishermen, lobstermen, boaters, and others. And Commissioner LaPointe will speak to how we believe that this can be done in harmony. What we're looking to for the future is an energy economy, a low-carbon energy economy that depends on electrification of our home heating system using much more efficient heat sources like ground source and air source heat pumps. We're not talking here about electric resistance baseboard heat, which is a thing of the past, which we recognize as inefficient. We're talking about high efficient new technologies that can be powered by wind, waves, tides, biomass, solar, you name it. This is the vision of the task force 5-gigawatt goal, because we did the numbers, and that's about what it would take to end Maine's dependence on fossil fuels to power home heat and transportation. If you look at the next slide, why offshore wind, wave, and tidal? Maine's offshore wind resource, as has been said before, is enormous. The red lines on this chart show that we are in the outstanding and, in some cases, superb wind resources as identified by the National Renewable Energy Lab. Offshore wind is the only resource in Maine that's capable of supporting this low-carbon energy future that's largely decoupled from foreign disruption, that would employ thousands of Maine people, which Kathy Renaud and others have and will submit testimony to you about the jobs that could be generated from advancement of this industry. We agree that energy efficiency and demand management must continue to be pursued, but we also recognize that our offshore wind resources is the hugest renewable ocean energy, renewable resource that we have. And if you look at the next page, the next slide, it shows you where this resource is. Yes, there's a lot in shallow water, and there's a lot in what is called transitional depth water. But the majority of it is in deep water, and which will be harnessed by new technologies, deep water floating platforms. Not only are the best winds farthest offshore, but the impacts from developing those winds go down, both in terms of scenic impacts, conflicts with other users, and environmental impacts, such as bird and bat impacts. The Ocean Energy Task Force legislation that you unanimously adopted last year has worked towards advancing those technologies to harness this deep water, wind, and wave energy. And it really put Maine on the map. As Commissioner Littell spoke to you yesterday when he's in meetings in Washington, D.C., it's recognized that Maine is now a leader in the promotion of these new technologies, and it really could be Maine's niche. And if you look at the next slide, I just gave this to show you a visual of, as you go farther offshore, how the projects become less visual. The last slide shows you the work that you put into the bill last year really did pay off. It's a map showing the three test sites that were identified by the State Planning Office and the Department of Conservation. They worked diligently for months and met dozens of meetings with fishermen, lobstermen, town officials, regional officials, in dozens of communities along the coast of Maine to identify these sites based on the best GIS data that we had. This really put Maine on the map and has made us a leader in development of this resource. So now let's turn to 1810 and what it does. What I first want to make clear is that today or tomorrow, an offshore wind developer or wave developer could come to the state of Maine and file a permit. That could happen today. What this law does is clarify our existing laws to establish a process that addresses the regulatory process that they would need to go through. So it clarifies existing law, it makes existing law more efficient, just like the law relating to onshore wind did, and it also addresses some of the issues that are before us with advancing this resource. The last handout I provided in the packet is a 4-page outline saying exactly what this bill does. It's true, the bill is daunting, it's 38 pages. We all wish that the bill had come here earlier. It was at the revisor's office for weeks, if not over a month. And I'm not sure why it took so long, but it did. In a perfect world, it wouldn't have. So what I tried to boil this down to, because I know that it will be used against us about how long the bill is that the bill may be long in terms of pages, but in terms of what it does, it's not that complicated. And so what it does, it's broken down in parts A through G. Each part has a different goal. And I'm just going to walk you through this outline very quickly because you can read it. Part A deals with energy policy and transmission, as well as the issue of electrification of heat and transport and how we move that forward in a sensible way. The task force recognized that we can't talk about a 5-gigawatt offshore wind goal without talking about the need for a robust transmission grid, and potentially with the ability to share the cost of the connection of the generator to that grid. It also addresses, as Representative Fitz said, the competitive solicitation process, because we know that if we're going to attract offshore wind, we're going to have to do something to encourage that, but it does so in a phased approach. It requires the Department of the Office of Energy Independence to make a determination on what a reasonable rate impact is, recognizing that all these offshore wind projects are currently at above market cost today, and then that would come to you. You would decide how much Maine is willing to pay, and then could direct the PUC to issue an RFP to attract offshore wind. Part B of the bill, it was based on some extensive work that Jeff Padeau, formerly of the Attorney General's office, did for the task force on our public trust doctrine and submerged land leasing. And this section clarifies the submerged lands leasing process and clarifies that use of it for wind is consistent with the public trust doctrine. Part C provides that some tax incentives for investment in ocean energy projects. That's pretty self-explanatory. Part D looks at community-based offshore wind around Lurk Islands. This is a very narrow carve-out that essentially says the only projects LURC will have jurisdiction are those projects within a mile of an island in the unorganized territory that is of a certain small size. And then we get to Part E, which is amending DEP law to clarify that offshore wind will need a site law permit if it's above 3 megawatts, as well as a Natural Resource Protection Act permit for all projects. And it clarifies what the rules are under that DEP will administer in permitting those projects. Part F relates to wave power. And then Part G, finally, is the coordination of state and local review to clarify that municipalities can have ordinances affecting these projects when they can do, you know, that they have to be in the municipal boundary, which is something that is not always easy, because this goes back to charters, municipal charters that may go back 100 years or so. So the municipality has to show that the project would be in its boundaries, and then what the interaction between state and local regulation is set forth in Part G. So that's a quick walkthrough of the bill in this outline form, which is, I want to point out, is only 4 pages long, and is trying in an attempt to really simplify what the bill does in 36 pages. So with that, I will turn it over to any questions or the next speaker. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Nikoski.